Welcome to the Backend Engineering Show with your host, Hussein Nasser. This is the show where we discuss the art and the craft of building software and cover recent news on backend technologies. If you enjoy the show, make sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel and rate it on Spotify and Apple Podcast. With that said, let's get on the show. What's going on, guys? My name is Hussein, and in this live stream podcast, we're going to discuss four topics that happened last week and maybe previous weeks. Facebook have moved completely too quick on their back end. There is a new technology called MASC, all stands for Multiplexed Application Substrate over Quick Encryption. What is that, and will it really replace VPN technology? We're going to find out. And also, Kafka is completely removing Zookeeper from their product. They just actually push that stuff. It's in the software. That's KIP 500. We're going to discuss that. What happened? What does that mean to Zookeeper, right? It doesn't mean anything. It's just Kafka design, right? But, and finally, .NET 5.0. What's the new features on that? How about we jump into it, guys? So, guys, we discussed Quick as a technology in various videos in my channel, and Quick as a technology is a great alternative to HTTP2. But the problem is a lot of people don't like HTTP2, especially database people. Right, because there is this excess of headers that most protocols really don't need in HTTP, right? You have these headers and content type. They don't need any of that. So the HTTP was designed for the web as a resource-based. So when we moved, we want the beauty of HTTP2, the idea of multiplexing multiple things and streams. And guys, I talk about HTTP2 and all that stuff. Check out the video right here if you want to learn more about it. Here, I think it's here, yeah. And so... there are some limitations in HTTP2, so the headers, and the other problems is the TCP head of line blocking, which I talked about in the limitation as well in HTTP2. Hit the mic. So when you have a single TCP connection, you stream logical requests, which are comprised of multiple packets, right? Each packet to the TCP stack is just a packet. But to you as an application, you have a group. Oh, these three packets is request number one. These three packets or four packets are request number two. These seven packets are request number three. The TCP stack doesn't know that. So if you have one packet that has been lost, it has to be retransmitted. And as a result, TCP says, wait a second, this packet has been lost and we didn't receive packet number three. So wait. Is going to stall all the packets as a result, despite packet number 1, 2, 3, or 4, 5, 6 received successfully, which belonged to request number 2, but we paused everything because the TCP stack has to wait for all the sequenced packet to arrive in sequence. So it says, all good, we received all the packets. That's called TCP head of line blocking. Head of line blocking is a problem in HTTP pipelining as well. So we want to solve this, but we have to remove TCP. So they built the same concept on top of EDB, and they call it Quick. This is very, very, very trivial explanation of Quick, right? So now Facebook decided to taste Quick. So they moved, first of all, they started moving their backend to Quick, right? They moved their backend to Quick, and... they started with re-implementing the Quick protocol itself, because that's Facebook strategy. Any protocol that is there, they have to write their own implementation, so they have full control over that. Plus, it's Facebook money; they have the money, they can do it. So they built their own reverse proxy. They built their own quick protocol implementation, and I think they call it MVFST. MVFST. And by the way, guys, we're discussing this article, and I'll try to paste it as I discuss so you guys can follow along. But this is the article we're discussing right now. All right? So they built this, and they started between their services, start shifting from TCP over whatever protocol they use, HTTP, into QUIC. Right? Some QUIC implementations are just HTTP3, which is on top of QUIC. Some of them are just native QUIC, because I have no idea. They didn't explain what their exact protocol on the back end is. So they start using QUIC on top of UDP, and then all of these communications is now happening between all these services using UDP. So immediately they saw a great performance there, and no problems as far as we discussed this article. And we talked about this article, but I'm gonna summarize this a little bit quickly. So as a result, they start moving, okay, we changed the backend between our services. Now all our services communicate in QUIC. Guys, the microservices de facto, is that a word, de facto? I think de facto, yeah. De facto to communicate between two services is what? Is gRPC. Remember, Facebook went the other route. And that's just interesting to me. Very, very interesting, right? That they went a different route and they built their own library, right? Because you need a library to communicate in QUIC. So that library is called MVFIST. It's just very interesting that that Facebook always finds a way to kind of moves away from the norm. That's what happened with GraphQL. That's happened with Cassandra. Well, Cassandra, they kind of took the idea from Amazon DynamoDB. But nevertheless, they always like Cassandra, GraphQL, React. React is just, it's a revolutionary thing, right? I don't use it, but it's revolutionary because look at how many people use it. But all of that stuff, Facebook is really innovative. Say what you want about Facebook if you don't like the company, but you gotta admit, they are very innovative when it comes to that. And they share this stuff. They just push it out to the public. And no, this is the open source. They talk about it. Cloudflare is another company that does that, which is I really respect companies that do that. So they moved it. They moved the QUIC protocol. Now, okay, the back end between communication is all QUIC. No gRPC, it's QUIC. Now that's another question. What's gRPC? gRPC, we talked about it, right? Check out the video right here. gRPC is built on top of HTTP2 because the beauty of stream processing and multiplexing is very, very powerful. And because you have like unary and bidirectional communication gRPC, now QUIC just completely went another route. So this MVFIST library is very interesting. I think it's open source, but I don't see anybody using it except Facebook. Will it be popular? And will it replace gRPC? What do you guys think? I think no. Especially, I'm going to tell you why. HTTP2 is not bad. HTTP2 has this little tiny, mini, mini problem. And yeah, the headers, you might say, oh, I don't like headers, but they are compressed. This HPAC compression, whatever it's called. So it's negligible, the amount of overhead that you have. Plus, you might say, Hussein, TCP overhead, you just talk about the head of line blocking, HTTP2. So gRPC uses this, so gRPC have the TCP head of line blocking. So what? If you have a reliable network, 10 gigabit, the amount of time that you're going to get a lost packet is less and less, especially if you have like wired network, not long distance, right? It's just very close to each other, very close. Again, guys, check out my video. Keep your database close and your servers closer. No, it's the other way around. Keep your servers close and your database closer. Why? Because the closer, the lower the latency, the better the performance. Otto says, Otto, thank you so much for joining me in the live stream. You have a great addition to the community. All your comments are awesome. I think in case of Quick and Facebook, they wanted to use it as quickly, pun intended, as possible. Developing their own library, they made sure it works best for them. I cannot agree more with you, Otto. Thank you. Thank you for all your insight, sir. So yeah, that's it. MV Fest. So they moved, now that they finished with the back end, they moved to the front end and said, let's try this on the Facebook app. And guys, Facebook app, now yeah, now you're talking long distance. Because I have a Facebook app on my phone right here, right? If it's on my phone, I gotta connect to Wi-Fi, and the Wi-Fi connects through signals, and that goes through lots more hops than if it's a back-end app, which is literally one-to-one between two pair. So the idea, if I have, well, I lost my train of thought. So the idea, if I have this mobile app, and then I try to communicate with a long distance, there is a chance of retransmission in the TCP. So if I'm using TCP as a transmission protocol, then the lost packet. If I'm using HTTP2, then the head of line blocking will happen. And if I'm sending a lot of requests, that you can feel that head of line blocking. Pull request number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 will have to wait, or no, so request number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 have to wait because request number 1, for some reason, there is a stinking packet that just were lost, and as a result, we get a blocked everything. So that's head of line blocking. So now Facebook brought this MV Fest, which is their quick library, to the Facebook app. And we're going to discuss what happened when they did that. Victor, super chat. Keep up the good work, Hussein. You helped me a lot with your WebRTC video. I've been longing to learn that, though I can afford this much. Thank you so much. You didn't have to do a super chat. Appreciate it. Thank you for the super chat. Appreciate it. So they moved to the Quick protocol in their Facebook app before they moved to the other applications like Messenger and Instagram and all the other stuff. By the way, I doubt they use Quick for their Messenger, but I might be wrong. So what the first thing they saw is just they saw when they implemented, they saw worse performance, ironically. When they implemented the Quick protocol on their Facebook app, they saw worse performance. And the reason was there's something called the telemetry and not telemetry, there's another word for it. Metrics. Right? Heuristics, that's the word. So the Facebook app uses obviously HTTP2, I believe, and that uses TCP. And if it uses TCP is a different protocol, so that the application was designed so that it tastes the network using the TCP protocol. So it says, hey, can I send this much? Can I send this much bandwidth? Can you handle this much bandwidth? This is all handled with the TCP flow control, right? And the application also have its own layer where it handles this flow control. That was very, very limited and was designed. These numbers, these heuristics was designed. It's just randomly for that app, just like that, was designed for the TCP. So when they used the same heuristics and implemented Quick, the app freaked out. It says, whoa, I sent the request and there was no delay at all because UDP, right? There's no flow control, there's nothing. So all of a sudden, the heuristic started to say, oh, I can send this much request then. It started sending thousand and thousand and thousand more requests. And as a result, the application couldn't handle it because there's CPU processing that needs to happen in the local level in order to do that. So what they did is, oh, this will not work. So they said, okay, hold on, app. Don't freak out. I know, it's just like, it's like you've been present for a long time and then someone just opened the door and then you flee, right? That's exactly what happened to Facebook. So what happened is they changed these parameters and they said, okay, let's taste different parameters. And as a result, they gain obviously more performance. It wasn't a great performance compared to what I was imagining. It's just like 8% or 6%. But to Facebook, that's really great. Again, guys, with Facebook, and then obviously they moved to Instagram and then all the video app, everything to Quick. So that's their path of moving to the stuff. So if you're just joining us, welcome. We're discussing different news topic. The first news is a Facebook moving to Quick completely. And that's just this first part. Then we're going to move to the other topics as well as we continue in this live stream. So yeah, so they moved their app. Now everything is on top of Quick. So the only problem they faced is this. How can we tune the app so that it doesn't freak out when you see this much bandwidth and it doesn't oversend? Because there's always a limit. Don't say you cannot send unlimited requests. There's some bottleneck somewhere. And that, when you hit that bottleneck, you're going to feel it, right? So there is limit for the wires, the limit on the CPU at your phone when it's using the app. There's a limit at the back end with the CPU usage. When I say CPU usage here, it's very important with Quick, because Quick, what it uses is it uses streams. And in order to these packets that you receive from the network protocol layer 4, you need to start assembling those packets into what the application thinks as, oh, this is now a channel, this is now a stream, this is now a request. And that assemblage takes time. We did not have this assemblage problem and CPU consumption in HTTP 1, for example, because it's a raw request. If you receive TCP packets in HTTP 1.1, that's it. These are literally the packets. They might be encrypted with TLS, but that's it. You don't have to wait for anything. Once you receive that packet, you decrypt. Once you see a new line, which whatever the HTTP 1 separator, I forgot, I think carriage return. Once you see that, that's the end of the request. Once you see HTTP 1.1 begin, that's the beginning of the request. That's how you find out. In HTTP 2, there's stream headers, actual packet headers, right? So that you have to wait for them. Then the MTU, the maximum transmission unit, all that stuff is just way, way complicated. So yeah, moving to Quick. Sometimes you can, if you think about it, is it worth to move to all that stuff versus just use pure HTTP 1? Really think about it. It depends on your use case. So that's the first news. There's a second news. Multiplexed application substrate over Quick encryptions. It's a very, very bells and whistles. So much bells and whistles. So, what's his name? Chris Wood from Apple. He used to work with Apple. Now he's with Cloudflare. Yeah, he's with Cloudflare. And Lucas Perdue, also from Cloudflare. Those guys are working on a new protocol. Guys, I don't know if you're familiar with how VPN works, but VPN works as a layer, almost as a layer 2 protocol. There is a specific protocol that allows that. But that's one concept of implementing this, right? The other concept is, if you want to implement proxying layers, right? You have a proxy protocol where I'm connecting to the proxy and then the proxy communicate on my behalf, right? How does proxy work? How does VPNs work? What you do is you go to your phone or your laptop or your computer, and you specifically say, okay, for this protocol, please use this proxy, okay? And what that means, that based on the protocol, again, there's SOX proxy, there's the SOX protocol where it will send all the packets to that proxy first. So let's say you have you want to go to google.com, but your computer have a proxy IP address. Says one, let's say, I don't know, proxy.com. Very shady, obviously. So what will happen here is any packet, even you going to google.com, assuming the proxying is HTTP or HTTPS, what will happen is all your packet will be sent to the proxy first. You might say, Hussein, if I send my packet to the proxy, then the IP address and the TCP packet is destined to the proxy, which is true. But how does the proxy know that I'm going to Google? The proxy have to actually decrypt the content to actually look at this. That's why proxies are very dangerous, especially HTTPS proxies. HTTP proxies, I mean, they look at your content anyway because it's unencrypted. But HTTPS proxies, man, you gotta think before using that, because what the HTTPS proxy actually do is they act like a physical man in the middle. You communicate to that, and then it sends you its own certificate. And then you have a encrypted channel between you and the proxy. And then you say, hey, I want to go to Google. A proxy knows that, hey, oh, you want to go to Google because there's a host header, right? That's why in HTTP 1.0, we couldn't do proxying because there was no host header. With the host header, oh, you want to go to Google? Nah, let me send the request to Google. So Google only knows the proxy in this case. And there is a lot of advantages for this. For God's sake, Service Mesh works like this. Service Mesh is all about proxying, right? Because if I have a proxy, like what's the benefit of proxy? That's one benefit, right? Hide my identity. But think about it this way. What if I am a Service Mesh, right? Forget about Service Mesh. I want to communicate between two services. One service A, service B. And to communicate between two services, you need to understand some sort of common protocol, right? So this common protocol, HTTP, might be HTTP2, might be gRPC. And as a result, the understanding of this protocol needs that this service or this app needs to have the library to communicate with each other, right? You have to have some sort of library. Twitter have Finagle. Facebook have MVFist, which we just talked about, and other libraries. I mean, if you have Python, you have to import request library so you can send a request. So this creates a little bit of overhead, right? Because now, if you want to join the microservices mesh, right, then you have to abide by this library, right? Because if you want to communicate with me, I'm sorry, you have to use this library. Because, and not only this library, the moment you use this library, that means you have to use this language. If my MVFist is written in Java, I don't think so it is, then your code must be written in Java because you have to import the library. How do you import Java code in Python? You cannot do that. So that's some limitation, right? Service Mesh comes and solves. So, hey guys, we're going to do the communication for you. You don't care. You just send us, you set us as your proxy, and you send a request as HTTP 1.1 unencrypted. Don't care about it because it's going to be loopback. It's in the loopback. Or it's going to be a sidecar container. And that, as a result, fine. Send it to me as a container, as the sidecar, or send it to me as a local host. And then I'll turn around and use a beautiful protocol upgrade. I'm going to use HTTP 1.2. I'm going to use HTTP 3. I'm going to use Quick. I'm going to use gRPC. You don't care as a client, as an application. You don't care. And in the future, if you wish to upgrade the protocol, let's say we used HTTP 2 and we want to move HTTP 3, no problem. Your application does not change. You just send a request to the service mesh, which is just, you don't really send it. It's just you set the proxy and it automatically does the job for you, which is magic. It is absolutely magic. So Mask here is a protocol that is designed for this communication to be encrypted first. So that's the goal here. So it's called multiplexed application substrate over quick encryption, right? Because the communication between you and the proxy is now encrypted, and the between the proxy and the destination is also encrypted, right? I don't think they talk about the destination between the proxy and then. They talk about mainly this concept, right? So this is a replacement for the SOX proxy, where instead of having this unencrypted channel, which is can be dangerous if your proxy is outside your local area network or not just local area, outside your computer, then you don't want that, right? So that's kind of saves things. Oh, yeah. Otto says, better to use connect request ahead to proxy decrypt them. Yes. So the connect method, HTTPS connect method, is a different way where it establishes a tunnel. It says, thank you for reminding me about that one. So what it will do says, okay, proxy, I want you to connect. So you send an HTTP, normal HTTP request to your proxy and says, connect to that. And what that will do, it will establish a tunnel between you and the destination. And then anything you send, it will immediately just go there, right? That means the proxy can't send it, and essentially. But it will just stream whatever you send to the backend immediately, just like a tunnel. We talked about tunneling. Check out the video of a SSH tunnel, just normal tunneling in general. So yeah, HTTP Connect. That's also a replacement for HTTP Connect, or could be a different protocol. They didn't specify that. So this is something new to discuss. I don't know how this will look like, to be honest. It's very, very in its infancy, but it's very interesting. Yeah. So you guys, if you're just joining us, we are discussing several news in this live stream today and answering some of your great questions. Happy Diwali for everybody who celebrates. Thanks, Rohit. Yeah, I'm craving a gulab jamun right now, that dessert. When I was to Bahrain, I was at my Indian colleagues were always like bringing this gulab jamun. It's an Indian sweet. It's just like, it's very, very sweet. So you have to drink it with either Arabic coffee or just normal coffee. How long have you been into proxy? Your knowledge is very deep. You'll be surprised. I've been into proxies for the moment. See my first video on the proxy. That's the moment I started learning about proxies in depth. So I would say 2 years or 3 years. So I've been searching about proxies for 3 years now, which is not long, in my opinion, because I think I still don't know much about it. Like, I'm still not comfortable talking about this HTTP connect method and tunneling. It's a lot of networking concept there, so that I need to learn more about it. But yeah, thank you so much, though. Appreciate it. Where I work for now from home, we have to use VPN on our laptop. Should I be worried about my personal information? So when you use VPN, what happens literally is, and network people, correct me if I said anything stupid. What happened is you have a machine here, right? And you're connected to a bunch of machines in your local area network, whether Wi-Fi, whether whatever router, right? And now there is your work computer right here. And then your work computer is connected, not necessarily your work net environment has multiple machines, has its own network, has its own router, right? What VPN does logically is take you as a computer and literally logically put you as part of that network. That's what it does. So as if any request, anything, any frame you send, it will be sent as if you're part of that network. And as a result, all your applications there will light up. That's the idea of this. Now you might say, Hussein, what are you saying? How can you put my machine there? The idea here, that's the VPN. What happened here, you establish a layer two communication encryption between yourself, your machine, and the VPN server. And then once you establish the keys, any frame you send will be translated it will be sent as if you are part of that network. So now anything is encrypted. So no one in the middle knows, but your work definitely knows. Again, I'm going to put double code there, but your work definitely knows, right? Because the VPN server located at your work, right? So anything you send will go through the VPN server. It's encrypted. So no one in the middle will know. Even your ISP will not know where you're going. Even DNS queries, all of this stuff is encrypted. So once you reach that, then once you start sending a request from that virtual machine, the virtual computer that was created, it was virtual, it will create a new IP address for you, everything. And now once you send that request to whoever outside, then it will go through your work proxy, all right, if there is a proxy, and will go to your work ISP, and those will be seen if it's unencrypted. Now, if I search, how do I get a girlfriend on your work machine? Will my employer see that? Well, I'm gonna answer, it depends, right? Regardless of whether you're VPN or not, this is exactly the same. If your work uses a proxy that is terminating proxy, and most enterprises do, and you can find out very easily by right-clicking, find in your work machine, say if there is a proxy IP address. If there is a proxy IP address, then yes. Then they are terminating all the traffic. If there is an HTTPS, right? Then they are terminating and serving you their own certificate, the work certificate, and they decrypting everything so they know every single thing that you do through HTTPS at least, right? If they have a SOX proxy, then anything, even your Oracle DB connection, right? They know that if you're going outside. But if they don't have that proxy, then no, they cannot know anything. And anyone who tells you, yeah, there is, they're not right. So that's why once you know how things work, you become more confident, right? Just like you know how things work. Just like, yeah, so nobody can bullshit you. Otto, do you agree with what I said? And any network. They can also do it transparently. How, Ali? Transparently. Strictly speaking, two risks. The software you install on your machine could, in theory, do something with your machine. And the second risk is, does it send other non-work traffic to you? Oh, my God, he's right. Otto always hits the bell. So, yeah, it depends. Like, what is the VPN proxy that you're using? If you're using the native operating system VPN, then maybe you're safe. But if you're installing some third-party VPN, then a little bit shady. You have no idea. Unless you install Wireshark and look at the traffic. Then there's this VPN splitting thing where does all your traffic now goes through your work? Like, what if you are searching personal stuff and you don't want that to go through your work, right? And you might say if that stuff is encrypted, then you might not have to worry if they don't have a proxy that terminates and look at that stuff. But if it's unencrypted, then you have to worry again. All right, guys, let's move to the next point. Zookeeper. If you're just joining us, we're discussing different news that happened and last week. Back in engineering, specifically, that's what I like to discuss. Like, most of the stuff is here in back end, but I sometimes touch on the front end and just general software engineering. So if you like this stuff, make sure to hit that like button and subscribe. Smash like, as the YouTubers say. Smash like right now. If you don't smash like, a duck will die, as PewDiePie says. Smash like right now. Can't believe I just said smash like. Okay, Zookeeper, Kafka, and Zookeeper. All right, I'm going to take a little bit of break. And we're going to join you soon. My dog is barking and I want to see what is wrong with him. Just a second. Be right back, guys. Ali says, I'll send you some configuration for a transparent SSL proxy. Must be trusted on the client. Yeah, because you work in a bank, right? So you must have definitely an HTTPS terminating proxy. I don't know if it's transparent though. Oh, but yeah, I'd love to learn about that. Thank you. Nice. All right. So we're talking about Zookeeper. So guys, Kafka. We talked about Kafka many times on this channel, right? Check out the video right here. Kafka, or just type Kafka Hussein. You're going to find my video. It's around 1 hour and 15 minutes, something like that. Talking about Kafka. But Kafka, guys, is a stream processing. That's how they market a stream processing layer, where you have a single broker. You can publish something to a topic. People or consumers can subscribe to a topic, and they're going to get this information from given partitions. These topics are breaking down into partitions, so they can, essentially, that's the concept of sharding, very similar to sharding. If topic get large, we need to partition this stuff. And there's the idea of consumer groups and all that stuff. We talked about all that stuff. Kafka, to manage this metadata, where, hey, we have topic called users, we have topic called news, we have topic called political news, right? All of this stuff. And we have, in this topic, there are 700 partition. In this topic, there are 300 partition. All of this stuff is kept in something called the Zookeeper. And Zookeeper is a high availability event store. It just stores data for you in a high available. So that if one machine goes down, the information will be transmitted into another machine, right? So that you can ask any machine for this information without goes down. So it's a distributed data store. Let's say you can talk about it this way. However, if you think about it, if you really think about it, HTTP, Kafka itself is a distributed store. Right, because it has the same concept. It distributes all this and it has the idea of brokers. So now Kafka ran into a problem with managing the state of the metadata in the broker, right, which is the topics, partitions, in the broker and also in Zookeeper. So most of the time they run problems into brokers having outdated metadata, right? And the other problem is that if Zookeeper goes down, the whole thing is useless. Despite the brokers are up, once Zookeeper goes down, the Kafka cluster cannot work because all of this stuff is stored in Kafka and in Zookeeper, right? So there are many problems with Zookeeper when it comes to Kafka. When it comes to Kafka, again, I repeat that, only when it comes to Kafka. It doesn't mean Zookeeper is bad. Why? Because they thought about this, like, wait a second. We are storing topics and we are storing data in the Kafka brokers and topics, right? Partitions. Why don't we just store the metadata also in the brokers themselves? So that we treat ourselves as the storage. So the metadata is stored, metadata is stored as data in the broker. So it's so meta, right? It's like the Kafka started storing their own metadata in Kafka. That's what they want to propose. So that they just eliminate all this overhead of maintaining Zookeeper as an extra layer. And this way, they don't have to sync the state between, this broker that spin up has knows about this topic, but we just added a new topic, so we need to add it to Zookeeper. And then one Zookeeper will finish this information, will push it down to the broker, and push is something Kafka is just going away from, because they you cannot handle push versus pull. Pull is always a good idea, right? Because you have, you take the rhythm of the client. The client asks for information, and then whenever the client is ready, they will pull information versus push. Push is like, how do you know the client will is on to push this information, right? I mean, you might say, hey, there's a TCP connection, right? Of course, that's how you push information. That's why the client is on. But even if the TCP connection is alive, pushing that message does not mean that the client, you don't know about the client's state. Maybe the client is processing a huge job and there's no CPU usage there. It's just dying right now. And you just pushed something in its throat. How do you know it's going to receive it or not? Are you going to maintain this state that, hey, we just pushed something, the client didn't get it? Does Kafka now maintain that stuff? That's how RabbitMQ does it, by the way. It's a disaster. It's a disaster to implement. So Kafka moved away from all that stuff to long polling, which is, hey, if you want something, ask me. And this way, I know as a client that if you're asking me, that means you're ready to receive information. That's why YouTube struggles with push notification. Why do you think you have this bell icon? Do you think because YouTube care about your being annoyed of a notification? No. They want to minimize their overhead because they cannot physically push this much notification. Imagine PewDiePie just uploaded a video, 100 million. You want us to send 100 million notification push to the users? How the heck do we know, right? 100 million users. That's just impossible. That will just, the act of spinning up all these processes to send this push notification is going to be insane. Although YouTube doesn't send notification to them, to the device itself, because that's done through Apple Notification Cloud, whatever it's called, and Android Google Notification Cloud. So they push it to Google, but there is a limit, right? They don't talk about this stuff, but I bet that's what's happening. Nobody can do this stuff physically. Push is hard. Pushing is very hard. Oh, some big brain things being discussed here. I hope someday I get this legend to understand this stuff. Oh man, don't say that. Believe me, whatever we discuss is not rocket science. Because, yeah, it might be a lot of convoluted stuff. That's my job. If you don't understand what I'm saying, that means I failed, in my opinion. Right? I try to simplify. I try to digest the mess out there and try to simplify it so I can understand it. And then I turn around and then produce it to you guys in a digestible manner. And I think some of you appreciate that. Some of you like that. Some of you just don't like my delivery style at all. All right, and I can't do anything about it. I'm sorry, because that's my personality. I'm chipper like this all the time. All right, and even in real life, when I talk, I'm like this. So I'm not faking myself here. So it's like a lot of people like, hey, speak normal. Don't speak like that. It's like, I don't know why they sound like that, but yeah, don't speak like that. Speak normal. What do you mean speak normal? I'm speaking normal. Sheesh. Darshan, dude, I am a noob. I'll just graduate the next year. I have a lot to explore. Yes, if you have this attitude that you have a lot to explore and there's no limit to the sea of knowledge, then you'll be unstoppable one day. Because always have this open mind that you don't know anything, and I don't know anything. Literally, I don't know anything. So yeah, Zookeeper is done. Again, let me fix that. Zookeeper is being removed from Kafka as a result, because it's a duplicated work. Plus all this Java stuff. I mean, yeah, Kafka is built on Java, but yes, too many Java virtual machines, just too much. Also, your channel's great, man. Got a lot to learn from you. Thank you so much. I love the way you simplify things. Appreciate it, Ram. Appreciate it. Thank you. I'm glad you. What happened with Kafka Zookeeper? Oh, we just discussed it. Kafka is removing Zookeeper from its platform. So now when you install Kafka, I don't know which release that will be, but you will not need to spin up Zookeeper as a result. So that, and the main reason is they found out that why are we storing the metadata, which is the topics and partitions and the position of each consumer in Zookeeper, where we can store it in Kafka itself. So they built this nice architecture right there. I'll send the link right here. It's very, very nice. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful picture. It's a terrific picture. Terrific. Terrific. Tremendous. It's a tremendous, beautiful picture. So they show how the new architecture where you have a broker and you have multiple brokers, and these brokers are also themselves leaders, and they essentially distribute the metadata itself. So the summary is Kafka says, hey, we're a distributed data store as well. Why don't we store the metadata in ourselves? That's how they solve it. Obviously, it took years. This project is big. Under KIP 500, yes, that's what it's called, KIP 500. KIP 500 is what this is called. All folks here, click the bell icon to test the notification push. Hey, no, don't kill YouTube. Yeah, even if you click the notification bell, by the way, YouTube will not send the notification every time because they just can't. I don't believe they can. Physically, implementation-wise, they can't. It's just not possible to send it to everybody. It's just, how do they know that you have turned on notification? That's just another information. I mean, they can know from Google or Apple, if you're using Apple or Google, Android, that information that you disabled notification for YouTube will be transmitted to the Google Cloud. And then when YouTube want to send a push notification to Apple so that you can send it to that particular user, they say, oh, don't bother because this user has already disabled notification. So apparently from what the messaging, what YouTube tells us, YouTube even don't know this, doesn't have this knowledge that users have turned on this notification. I think this might be a privacy thing. Right, because once you turn off notification, I don't think that Apple transmit this information to you. So can you please talk about Kafka overheads? Well, Kafka is an overhead to implement, right? Because there's a lot of stuff there. You have to spin up. Well, it now become easier, right? And I don't know. I have to make another video to test Kafka without Zookeeper. But yeah, just spinning up multiple Kafka brokers and then communicating between the brokers themselves, that's just a lot of work, right? And when you write to a broker, that's something I like about that. In the client app with Kafka, when you want to communicate, you specify a list of brokers with their IP address, which is neat, in my opinion. You push the knowledge of the load balancing to the client itself. A lot of people do that, I first suspected that. It's like, why don't you just push that load balancing concept to the backend, like normal people, like load balancer? You have one IP address, and whenever you send me a request, I'm gonna load balance it to the other servers. But this, they just removed the extra layer of the reverse proxy, and they said, hey, here are our public IP addresses of all the brokers. We have 7 brokers. When you communicate with one, it gives you the other IP addresses and says, okay, you can communicate with this and this and this and this, up to you. So the client have the freedom to connect to a server, just like the old days when you want to play a multiplayer game, right? You pick which server to connect to. So that's called client load balancers. The load balancing becomes on the client level. right? So the client pick which server, and then you can choose different servers. And obviously, when I say choose, I'm not talking about the user. I'm talking about the client library, which is smarter than the user. If it's up to user, the user will always choose one server, right? That they know that works. Hi, Hussein. Thank you for the high quality videos. I'm a fan of yours from South Korea. Wow, I think you were the first from South Korea. I never seen anyone. Thank you so much, Sinwo. Appreciate you, dear. Right. Oh, I have five colleagues from work, all from South Korea. Goes without saying, I love Korean barbecue, obviously. Here in California, it's a big thing here. But we don't go to the real barbecue places because it's different. We only know the popular touristy ones. If the IP changes, client load balancer fails, right? Yes, that's a good question, right? What if IP changes, right? If the IP changes, here's the thing, right? If that's why you have multiple ones, you have to communicate between multiple ones, right? If one IP address fails, the client will feel it. It's like, oh, this one is down. Let me try the other one, right? But most of the time, that failure will not be happening because that also have its own load balancing. Because when you communicate with a broker, it doesn't mean that broker will do the work for you. It will just facilitate the request to the actual leader, just like Cassandra. I believe Cassandra works very similarly. All right. Cassandra has also this idea of nodes. And then you pick one node to connect to, and then that nodes communicate with the leader. Right. There is a leader election and all that stuff. Hello. My question is how to learn backend engineering in the right way. I recently subscribed to your channel and I found many useful tutorials, but I'm not sure how to start. That's a good question. Let's do it right now. So, backend engineering, guys. I'm planning to make a course. Not definitely on not Udemy because I hate that platform. But I'm going to move to my own course platform. But backend engineering, I have three playlists. Backend engineering. Where's that thing? Backend engineering. I can't find it. Backend engineering. I can't find it. Of course, I can't find it. So backend engineering, I have three playlists, guys. Hopefully I can paste it right here. I have a beginner. Can I paste all of them? Ugh, chat doesn't tell me this. That's a lot of text. So, sorry about that. Dead air. All right. So this is the beginner playlist. I just pasted it right here in the chat. So there is a beginner, intermediate, and advanced. That's all sorted based on my understanding. And you can watch the list from top to bottom, especially the beginner. Because the beginner, I believe what new engineers should learn is TCP stack, OSI model, things like that. So this playlist should help you. Just watch it from top to bottom. They are prioritized. And hopefully in the future, I'll create a course, which is just obviously one-stop shop instead of watching different videos. But yeah, and ask a lot of questions. I know very little about Kafka. Looking at information available, looks like they are adding Raft. Correct, yes. Raft is that protocol, what is it called, the election, the consensus protocol, right? Again, I don't know much about Raft as well. But yeah, to elect the master of between these brokers, they use Raft as a software. And I don't know much about Raft. But yeah. My man. All right. Final news before we end that stream. What do we have? The final news. .NET 5.0. So guys, .NET. Who here uses .NET? Who here uses .NET? Raise your hand. I feel like I'm in class. If you guys develop in .NET like I did for the past 16 years, even more than that. .NET is a technology built by Microsoft. It's a framework that you build, write programs for, and Once you install the .NET runtime on the operating system, you will be able to run your application on that operating system, right? And they have .NET 5.0 for Windows, Mac OS, Linux, and x86, x64, and the new thing is ARM, this new ARM architecture. So yeah, they started supporting all this stuff. So .NET 5, I'm a little bit surprised that they called it .NET 5, in my opinion, because I didn't see a lot of new features. They just improvement in performance. So I'm surprised they called it 5.0. And maybe they run out of numbers. I don't know, they could have called it 4.10 or 4.11. But yeah, I don't know what's the breaking change to call 5.0, in my opinion. But let's read through the new changes. Not me. Depending on the requirement, I do sometimes. Yeah, Ali uses .NET. So, .NET. Let's read through the highlights. .NET 5.0 is already battle-tested and is being hosted for months on .NET, and Bing.com. So Bing is written on .NET. Here you go. Of course it is. I'll be surprised they choose another language. Right, so Bing.com, right, which I don't know who uses Bing, right? But if you use Bing, then you know now you now know that it's built on top of .NET. So that means that whatever the operating system in the back end, it just works. The second highlight is in .NET 5.0 is performance is greatly improved across many components and is described in details. In the performance of gRPC. Look at this stuff. So I want to read more about this, the gRPC and performance, guys. That is really nice. You know, guys, I don't know if I can send you this, but this is mad. I'll send you this. Do you know what is the best performance when it comes to gRPC library? What's the best gRPC library? Because gRPC supports multiple libraries, Python, JavaScript, right? PHP. You know what's the best that gives you the higher throughput, request per second? Right? Because request per second, that's the most important thing in gRPC, multiplexing, HTTP2, right? Who can make a guess? The best one, take a guess right now before we jump. What is the best gRPC platform? Nope, not that one. Look at this. Rust is the first one with 50,000 requests per second in gRPC. Wowzy. And I make sense. It makes sense because Rust is not a garbage collecting language. And if that, they use the memory in a very efficient way. And if they write it well, they can squeeze performance. So if you want to build a gRPC client, probably use Rust. But look at the second one. The second one is .NET. I am blown away. .NET has the best, the second best, and it's not by much. 48,000. It's just 20,000. Who cares? I'm not going to send more than 48,000 requests. Second, I am intrigued. Go Microsoft. Golf clap for you, Microsoft. 48,000 requests per second in gRPC and .NET 5. It is fast. Wowzy. The third, guys, a lot of you are a fan of Golang. Golang is the third. 47,000 requests per second. And the fourth location is CPP, C++. 45,000. Whoa, that's okay. How is CPP failing? Okay, this is not acceptable. How is CPP, non-garbage collected language, right? And it's closer to the metal that it does not outperform .NET. I bet you that it's just an implementation detail. If you re-implement the C++, it could outperform Rust and outperform .NET. I'm really surprised about this one. Again, garbage collection is not everything, but definitely it's a factor because when you build all these streams, you reserve memory location as long as CPU bandwidth. So I don't know where they come to these numbers, but the worst thing, I'm gonna, and then goes down until the worst thing is Ruby. So avoid using Ruby in gRPC. And definitely Python. Yuck. 4,000 requests per second. Ugh. Again, 4,000 requests is a lot, guys, by the way. But still. So Java is 36,000 requests per second, 25 requests, 1,000 per second. Kotlin, which is the Android thing. Lua. Wow, Lua. I'm hearing a lot of good things about Lua. Lua is 18,000 requests per second, gRPC. And Node is Node.js, 12,000. There you go, guys. There you go. Node.js. We just said it, 12,000. Node.js. So yeah, when I say .NET, I mean C#, VB.NET, F#, if you're into that kinky kind of things. So yeah, I like that. Is it a breaking change for to say it 5.0? To kind of release a new release. Maybe they're just going to go with a new release, just like Firefox. Oh, version 36. Chrome 58. So C#, another highlight. C# 9 and F# 5 offer new programming language supports. They offer new programming language supports, top-level programs, records for C, C++, C#, not C++. JSON serialization, faster JSON serialization. So if you're using .NET 5 and you're serializing JSON and deserializing JSON, good news, your JSON serialization just became better because they improved the JSON. So if you have a huge payload coming from your server as a JSON, it comes as a string, right? It comes as a bunch of bytes. To actually serialize it into .NET objects, JSON .NET objects, now this is way, way, way faster. All right. And HTTP, HTTP 1.1 client, HTTP 2 clients, all of that stuff is great. And a lot of other improvement, WebAssembly, the garbage collection. They improve their garbage collection in .NET as well. So it's like much, much more efficient. All right, guys, that's all for us today. A beautiful stream. I'm going to leave you here. I'm going to chat a little bit, and then we're going to end that stream. Thank you so much for joining us today. We discussed many discussions. We discussed four topics. Let me know if you like this new format or not. We might change it. We might go back to just the normal Q&A. Might just throw it back in and just pick one topic and discuss it for an hour or an hour and a half or so. But what do you guys think? What do you guys think? Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you. For people who are listening on the podcast, thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for everything. I'm going to see you on the next one, guys. You guys have a wonderful weekend. And we're going to see you very, very soon. I don't have any videos scheduled for this week so far. So I might discuss a few news here and there and see if something worth discussing. But we'll see. So don't worry if you joined late. I'll schedule another stream for next Saturday as usual. I'll let you know the time ahead. Sorry about that. I'll try to stream all at the same time, 7 a.m. I know it's very early in some places, but it's what works for me. I can't stream any later than that because I have things to attend to on a Saturday. But thank you so much. You guys take care. Love you. And I'm going to see you in the next one. You guys stay awesome. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thank you. Goodbye.